Preachers, teachers, and fellow leaders of the church. I am Carrie.
I am Emmy.
And welcome to Preacher's Report this week today. This week's readings, for those of you who are in the Revised Common Lectionary, your Old Testament reading is Deuteronomy 26, 1 through 11. Psalm is Psalm 91, 1 through 2, and then you skip ahead to verses 9 through 16. New Testament reading is Romans 10, 8b through 13, and the Gospel is Luke 4, 1 through 13. Narrative lectionary, you are still in Mark, with chapter 10, verses 17 through 31.
Happy Lent, everybody. We are
Happy Lent.
Coming up on the first Sunday of Lent. If you did not know that already, then now you know.
Now you know, and it's probably time to start preparing.
Right. Maybe you don't celebrate Lent in your church, or maybe you're not part of the Lenten celebrations. Lent is the traditional, one of the earliest Christian seasons. It is the 40 days of the week preceding Easter, so it doesn't count Sundays. It starts on Ash Wednesday.
Because they're all mini Easters.
Right. And the original purpose of Lent was to help new faithful Christian members who wanted to be baptized and become full members in the church when they were adults. In their study and their preparation, and they would go through fasting and repentance and prayer and confession and use these 40 days as sort of a repetition or a literal remembering of Jesus's 40 days in the desert. And then on Easter Vigil or on Easter Sunday, they would be baptized and they would become full members in the congregation, which is why Easter Vigil is often very much celebrated as a party and revolves around a really big dinner, because it was usually First Communion for those adult converts.
Very nice recap of Lent, Emmy.
Thanks, Carrie.
I really liked it.
If you grew up Catholic, you know it's Lent because you ate meat accidentally on Friday and had a sickening feeling in your stomach.
It's true. I grew up, so my dad is Catholic, my mom is Lutheran. And, like, every Friday during Lent, like, I'd come home and Dad would be like, so did you eat meat today? And I'd be like, oh, definitely had pepperoni pizza for lunch. Then I'd feel bad. But most of the time, that was also what I knew it was Lent because I grew up a church nerd. But, like, I would always be remembered at school at lunchtime because it would be like, we're having fish sandwiches. And I'd be like, oh, that's right.
Yep. Fun
Don't
fact,
eat meat
it's
today.
The McDonald's calendar does rotate around Lent. Because that's the
it
only
does.
Time the filet fish is available.
Yeah. And usually there's, like, some deal that's, like, two for
right.
$2.22 or something. Yeah. It might not be true this year. I don't know. I haven't checked my local McDonald's for their marketing. But all I'm saying is in years past, there's been a pattern of McDonald's sales.
Yeah. I remember when my high school psychology teacher told us that, like, McDonald's comes out with the filet fish once a year because it's specifically for Catholics who don't eat meat on Fridays. And I was
yeah.
What? What? And it's the weirdest little, like, cultural holdover that still sort of affects secular culture. And wouldn't it be nice if we had maybe things that were more positive that affected secular culture? Like,
yeah.
Everything dead stops on Sundays because we're not going to make anybody who's paid less than $15 an hour work on a Sunday.
I try really hard not to buy things on Sundays. Kind of my deal. Also, for those of you who do not grow up Catholic and you are like, hey, wait, why can you eat fish, which is a meat, on Fridays? Because it's meatless Fridays.
Right.
And I believe, which this could be a rumor, but I've always heard the justification that it started in Rome and fish sales were not doing well. And they were like, hey! Would this be okay? And people were like, yeah. So, so fish merchants then, you know, were like, yay, you can eat fish though. So.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's an interesting tidbit from history.
I would believe that story.
Yeah. Yeah. So, fish is not a meat, everyone, because fish markets weren't doing well. And they were like, hey, Catholic Church.
Well, that's kind of interesting considering that, like, Italy has so much coastline. Okay,
right.
Whatever. We're just gonna.
Right.
We're gonna take you to the news.
Yeah,
listeners.
Let's go to the news. So just real quickly, because I saw it briefly in a news update that I get, the Oregon standoff people surrendered. So after, like, 40 some days. So that's. Yeah, and now they're, like, awaiting trial or whatever.
Yeah.
Again, as a reminder, they were
occupying federally owned lands, and claiming that they were legally allowed to do so. They were not.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what the Constitution says. If the government owns land, you can't just go stand on it with a gun and say that it's yours now.
Right.
Weird.
Plus, isn't there something in the Constitution that says, like, the government can be like, hey, we need this land?
Right. That'd be eminent domain. And...
yeah.
I don't know exactly what the constitutional lines are in re-eminent domain, but I would guess, considering that most of the people who wrote the Constitution were Federalists, which means that they were very into centralized government, mm-hmm. that the government has a lot of power to take your land in yeah. that.
Yeah. Anyway, just a quick remembrance of freshman year of high school civics class.
And I was relying mostly on what I've learned from the soundtrack of Hamilton.
So proud of both of us right now.
It's just like, I feel like Hamilton would have argued, like, no, we need to take that land. And then Washington would have been like, all right.
speaking of politics.
Oh.
Well, really quick, speaking of Hamilton, they have announced that they're officially going on a U.S. world tour, so I'm very excited about that. I mean, obviously they are, because it's been super successful, but still it's happening, and I'm excited.
I'm interested, have they announced kind of how they're going to do ticket sales? Because ticket sales are going to be impossible.
I don't believe they have announced.
Okay. I would love if they did a lottery, like, I mean, it would be great if they did a $10 lottery literally day of for every single ticket. They probably can't.
Right.
But it would be nice if they sort of mimicked, for those of you who don't know, every day before a showing of the Broadway sensation Hamilton, they have what is called a ham for ham lottery raffle, because Hamilton is on the $10 bill and you can, put your name in to potentially get a ticket to Hamilton for $10, which is amazing because you get front row seats. You're like basically in the orchestra pit. So it's really good seats. And, you can't scalp, I mean, I guess you could scalp them if you like went physically there. But you have to physically be there. They tried to do an online thing and it crashed, which is unfortunate. You have to physically be there. And yeah, it's just a lottery. And it enables a lot of people who wouldn't maybe otherwise get to see an amazing Broadway show do so for not a ton of money.
Yeah.
Well done, Hamilton.
Well done, Hamilton. I know a couple other, I don't think it's a new, like brand new idea. I think the price is new. Like it's lower than others. But if you are having troubles coming up with monies to go see some of the stuff, one of the best ways to get that I have found for people to, communicate that is through Twitter. And, cause I know like Book of Mormon has done like, hey, who wants tickets? Cause we're not sold out yet. So
yep.
Yeah. Just a plug for Twitter there. Cause I enjoy it.
Twitter's real great.
Cause it's real great. It is. Anyway, Hamilton is coming near you, possibly, sometime soon. They have not released details, I don't think.
Speaking of Hamilton founding fathers and Federalists, presidential campaigns continue. Ugh. The New Hampshire caucus was last week. So here, I finally kind of broke this down so that I could understand it and that people that were asking me about it could understand it. So basically, what caucuses and primaries do is determine how many of delegates from each state the each candidate will get at the national convention. So the Democratic National Convention or the Republican National Convention, which is when the candidate for presidency backed by that party is usually announced. Usually, by the time we get up to the national conventions, we have a sense of who's sort of the front runner. Mm-hmm. And that's often very much determined by the early caucuses, such as Iowa and New Hampshire. So that's why everybody's paying attention to Iowa and New Hampshire. Results are, Donald Trump pulled out 10 delegates in New Hampshire. Kasich got 4, which was a big surprise. Cruz got 3, so right now that brings Trump to 17 total, Cruz to 11, Rubio has 10. Still very much anybody's game in that race. And also in the Democratic race, because in New Hampshire, Sanders took 15 Democratic delegates, Clinton took 9, which brings totals to Clinton 32 and Sanders 30, but Hillary Clinton also has 6 superdelegates from New Hampshire and 368 pledged superdelegates besides. What is a superdelegate? I don't know. I looked it up. Superdelegates is a delegate to the Democratic National Convention or the Republican National Convention that is automatically seated based on their status as a current party leader, or if you're Democrat, it could also be a former party leader or elected official. So, like, Bill Clinton could be a Democratic superdelegate. State primary results portion the non-superdelegates, but superdelegates get to pick whoever they want. And this arose in between 1980 and 84 because there was concern that popular vote was putting forward... primary voters were picking candidates that parties feared were too extreme, especially because primaries and caucuses, people don't... those are more often voted in by sort of more passionate voters. It doesn't necessarily get to the heart of middle America, and so they were putting forward candidates that maybe were not as viable in a general election. And so the Republican and Democratic parties came up with this idea that essentially created the party a greater voice for the party establishment in the nomination process. Is that problematic? Did it contribute to the fact that we have a two-party system that's continually polarized and can't get anything done, and we can't seem to get out of a two-party system? I would argue maybe it did, because you're taking the people's voice out of it and basically maintaining, like, if you get into Democratic or Republican politics and you're in that, then you get to stay in it. And I'm really troubled by the Democratic policy that even if you were a former party leader or elected official, you can still be a superdelegate. Like, that worries me. You're out of office for a reason. Like, you should have a seat. But I am not a political science major. Maybe there are some things that I'm missing. We're just going to eighth commandment this and say that I am going to assume the best of all people until proven otherwise. So maybe there's a really good reason for doing the primaries and caucuses this way. But anyway, that is how delegates shake out, and that is what a superdelegate is.
Well, thank you for that report, Abby.
You are welcome, Carrie.
I mean... yeah, like, I agree with you that seems kind of messed up. Yeah. I mean, I guess I can see somewhat, like, I can see having former leaders only in that being, like, you've been through it, maybe you know some wise stuff, like, hey, you were president for 8 years. Maybe
right.
You will know more than, you know, someone that's just, like, coming up now. But I also agree with your concern of, like, yeah, but take a seat.
Well, it keeps people who've previously been in power, and then
right.
People who play kind of the political game their way keeps them in power as, it helps those people achieve power as well, and it sort of disenfranchises people who are maybe trying to achieve political power in non-conventional ways.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm gonna not make West Wing references.
This election cycles have to just be really hard for you, Carrie.
So hard. Because I just want to watch the West Wing all the time. I mean, I already do.
Right.
And then, like, it just makes me want to write in, you know, Aaron Sorkin and Martin Sheen.
Right.
On the ballot. And
lizard people.
Go
always write in lizard people.
Lizard people.
I don't know why, but that's, like, a thing. I've never looked it up, but apparently there's a conspiracy that the government is actually controlled by lizard people. And so people will, people who are maybe on the fringes of society will periodically write in on a ballot lizard people. Or people who are just being weird, I suppose.
Interesting.
It's often referenced in the Welcome to Night Vale series.
Ah,
the lizard people who run the government.
Mm-hmm. Very nice.
Moving on.
It just makes me think of, there's a episode of the show 30 Rock where they're talking about voting and... Jack Donaghy is played by Alec Baldwin. But Jack Donaghy is a very staunch, passionate Republican. He's talking to Kenneth, this lowly page, about voting, and Kenneth says, my religion, forbids us to vote. So I just write in the Lord's name. And Jack Donaghy goes, that counts. We vote. We count those. It just makes me laugh.
People do count those. I remember that. There was a really close gubernatorial race in Minnesota a while ago, like 8 or 12 years ago, and I remember when they listed, like, all of the write-ins because it was so close, and they were trying to follow up with a couple people. Like, they were trying to figure out if somebody who had significantly misspelled a candidate's name really meant to vote for that candidate, or if they were, like, being ironic and weird. It was just very weird.
Weird. When I was in college, I voted, and a bunch of us wrote in our... not for president. I voted for, like, legit for president, but for the sheriff of the county, a bunch of us wrote in the guy that led our student orientation. Because that's fun, you know?
And I was problematic.
It could have easily been problematic. It's not something I would recommend, but it was fun at the time. That sounds like the title of a memoir.
It's true.
It was fun at the time. Probably not my memoir, because I don't break rules very much, but someone, somewhere should write that book. Okay, I feel like we're stalling because we don't want to get to real news.
I don't want to get to real news, but let's just...
I don't want to talk about it today.
Okay, let's just...
I mean, we should, but...
Let's just get through this.
Okay, so guns are back in the news.
Because it's been 2 weeks since they were, so we have to get back to guns because...
Exactly.
You can't go more than 2 weeks in America without a gun incident.
Yeah, so I got an alert this morning that, just this morning, two 15-year-old girls were shot outside of a school in Arizona. It's very new news, so we don't know much about it. But police are unsure if the two girls actually attend the school. They were shot outside on a patio, I believe. And they're seeing it as an isolated incident, meaning there is no active shooter. There's also a weapon found by the two girls, so people are assuming that it's people are assuming it's a school shooting. I don't think it is. It seems like a problem between these two 15-year-old girls that they decided to settle with weapons, which says a lot about our culture and makes me mourn them because that is not the way to settle a dispute.
And I think one of the speculations was because only one weapon's been found so far was that it was either a murder-suicide, like one girl threatened the other and shot her and then shot herself, or that it was a double suicide, that these girls had somehow arranged to die together. Which is just, it's just heartbreakingly sad, and I don't know what to say about it, except for we need to be more careful with who has access to guns in this country. Like, 15-year-olds should not have access to guns. Yep. Nope, just shouldn't. Shouldn't have that as a resolution. Nope. Shouldn't have that as an operating option. And, on that note, I'm not entirely sure that they should be an operating option at the degree that they're at for police forces either, where it seems to be the immediate go-to for how to resolve issues. Whenever you come upon somebody who's at all distressed or violent, the immediate go-to is shoot them, seems like right now. And I'm very troubled about that. I think that's not good.
Continue.
No, go ahead, Carrie.
Well, I just was going to say, I feel like that leads into the story from Roseville.
Yes.
Which
is my hometown.
Yeah.
That's where I grew, like, when you say Roseville, Minnesota, it's 5 minutes north of St. Paul. That's the high school that I grew up at, is 5 blocks from where this happened.
Yeah, I spent a couple years not too long ago.
That's right.
Tramping around Roseville, Minnesota.
Yeah.
The manager at Chipotle knows me.
Probably not anymore because all the Chipotles are closing. But
it's true. Probably not anymore. But back in the day, he did it. It was fine.
Do you want to talk about Roseville? And then I'll follow up with the...
Okay. So, in Roseville, Minnesota, police shot and killed a man that they found hiding in a closet after he stabbed a police dog on Wednesday night. Roseville police are talking about the dog named Otis. He was taken to the University of Minnesota for treatment and is now at home with his handler. Police found the suspect holding a large knife in the closet. And police chief said that the suspect made a stabbing motion, which struck Otis, the dog, in the jaw. At that point, the officers opened fire, which killed the man. the five officers involved in the response, two fired their weapons, according to police. And the suspect that they found, that they shot, they have had previous contact with for mental health issues. The suspect also had a warrant for, or an outstanding warrant for failure to respond to a citation of giving false information during an incident last year. And this warrant was factored into the decision to enter this man's apartment, where this whole thing happened.
Yeah. The man has not yet been identified. I think we were supposed to get an ID from the coroner today, but I haven't seen one come out. And right, he was, you know, attacking a police dog with deadly force, which is obviously bad, but the fact that they had to shoot and kill him, you know, they shot with the intent to kill this man, that was how we determined it was best to neutralize the situation, was to take someone's life.
That's the thing that's getting me, is that, okay, you go into, I can understand being a police officer, well, I can't understand being a police officer, but if I can try to put myself in those shoes of going into a suspect's house with the dog, and A, having major loyalties to the dog.
Sure.
Let's be honest. Because they're not only, like, they're not really a pet, they're your partner. Like, they're, yeah, you know, you're very tied to them. So there's that. I can also understand being fearful of what you're going to come into with, of what you're walking into, because you know this person has mental health issues. And opening a closet and seeing a man make a strike, stabbing motion and stabbing your dog in the jaw. I completely understand being upset by that and, being scared for your life and being scared for your dog. I understand all of that. I don't understand shooting to kill.
Yeah.
I understand shooting. I even understand shooting to injure, to try and, I mean, it's not like the first thing that I would do, hopefully. I've never been in that situation. But I understand somehow reacting to get the suspect to not be stabbing, to contain the suspect is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
Like, to somehow settle him down, and so you don't get stabbed, so no one else gets hurt, so the dog doesn't further get hurt. I completely understand that. But shooting to kill shouldn't be the first response, in my opinion.
Right. I think it's, you know, just thinking of, like, media depictions of police and that kind of thing, and you so infrequently see that kind of shoot-to-kill philosophy on a TV show. Like, if you're watching NCIS or Law & Order or whatever, if you shoot to kill, it's at the very end of the episode, and they've spent 45 minutes developing just how evil and committed to be evil this person is.
Right.
It's very rare that you open the episode, you know, and maybe now they've probably switched this, but, like, it would have to be a special episode where they focus on, like, shooting first and then asking questions later.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we're having, in, when we shoot first and ask questions later, that's in, like, some sort of, that's in a war movie. That's in Star Wars, where, like, okay, the clones are bad and the clones are going to kill you. That's a Matrix mentality of, like, you have to destroy everyone in this room before they can kill you. And that's not the mentality that I want to live with.
Right.
So, on that note, last week, this happened just, right around the same time as we were recording our podcast, so we didn't get it in last week. Last Friday, in Arizona, a young man, there was a suicide call, to the police, so a warning of a suicide. I'm not sure if the young man made the call or somebody else did, but so, police were sent to a young man's apartment in Arizona. He told police that he had a knife and he was going to hurt himself, and so they drew their firearms and shot him. Which makes no sense to me now that I'm reading these sentences together, because you...
Right.
You want to stop him from hurting himself, not shoot him. Okay. But, so the huge issue with this, and one of the reasons that it still got some media attention, was that this young man was named Caden Clark, and he had some visibility on YouTube because he's uploaded videos of his service dog, who is a Rottweiler named Samson, that can prevent him from self-harming during an emotional episode. He has Asperger's, and the service dog helps him with self-harm issues. But there's other videos on the YouTube channel that had gone less noticed, and they were videos about Caden's transition from female to male and his challenges and struggles, which I can't even imagine. I mean, I've been friends with people as they're transitioning, and I can't imagine going through that, and I can't even imagine going through that and having the additional component of Asperger's and self-harming episodes. Caden's parents still refer to him as she, and so most of the original media, and most of the original reports named Caden as female and referred to him by a female name, which is, not the way he referred to himself. And so it's this additional, like, we have mental health and police brutality and trans issues all sort of coming together in this, and it's heartbreaking. It's just the tendency that we have as Americans to go to violence as a solution, and to brutal violence is just, I mean, we've covered it. It's not what Jesus would do. Just stop doing it. Gosh.
Yeah.
It breaks my heart.
Mm-hmm. And
moving on.
I feel like it's gonna make me really unpopular right now. But
it's okay, whatever. Say the thing.
So I saw a preview for the movie Deadpool. And okay. I am excited to see the movie. I think it's gonna be hilarious. Like, there's been good things going on, right?
Sure.
However, in the preview, I was actually like physically ill from seeing the violence in it. Like,
I mean, isn't Deadpool an assassin?
Yeah. And like, I get that. However, like, slow motion stabbing with blood spraying is not something I need to see. You know, like, I get that you're killing someone and I just don't need it in slow motion and like right in my face like that.
Yeah. No, agreed.
I'm not one to be like, it's the violence in the media that's messing up our children's minds. Because, like, I think there's a ton more going on than just that. Although, I think, the older I get, I'm like, no, this could be very much be a factor. Because I didn't realize how desensitized I was to violence for a while. Mm. And then, until I started getting resensitized, and I was like, oh, no. But yeah, just watching Deadpool, it made me think of the movie Spy with Melissa McCarthy. Mm. That's a total comedy. Like, it's, like, Melissa McCarthy doing her thing. Like, she, you know, was a tech person, and then she becomes a spy, and it's a comedy. But there is slow motion, like, violence, like, extreme, where I and the person I went to see the movie with, like, we both closed our eyes and was like, I can't watch this. And I was just like, you know, maybe the fact that we show this, like, we're okay with showing this in our movies. Whereas, like, places in England are not cool with that, mm-hmm. but they'll show, like, more graphic sex scenes. Like, maybe that's contributing to our culture of, let's respond with violence. You know, like, because that's what we see. Anyway, that is my Carrie's unpopular soapbox. Thank you for listening.
Here's how I'd want to clarify your soapbox, is I think, you know, one of the things we like to do is say, like, oh, it's making our kids desensitized. I think it's making everyone desensitized.
Exactly, yeah.
Like, you can talk about video games, and I think that often comes up of, like, violent video games make our kids desensitized. Okay, because kids play video games versus adults, you know, adults making this argument usually don't play video games.
Right.
But, like, we all have probably seen an episode of A Law and Order because it's constantly on.
Right.
You know, and movie previews, and, like, Die Hard is a Christmas film and, like, runs on Christmas channels.
Yeah.
It's not a youth thing. It's an everybody in America consuming the same kind of media, which treats violence, especially violence with the intent to kill, as a throwaway segment.
Right. So anyway...
All right. Okay. Here's some good news. John Hopkins Hospital is Yay! About to perform the first kidney and liver transplants between HIV-positive patients.
Which makes me really happy. I saw that and I was like, I am excited that people with HIV aren't being told that they're like, well, you're a lost cause. Like,
right.
You're just gonna die anyway. You know, like, way to be like, hey... You know, you're HIV positive. This person was also HIV positive. I believe that's how that's working. And, like,
yeah.
So we're, like, we are able to do transplants.
Right. We're no longer, we don't have to waste the organs of people who are HIV positive. We don't have to say to HIV positive people, like, you can't have an organ transplant because you're so, your health is so compromised. Like, we're finding some solutions.
Right.
Which is good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so a news story that came before me that I was just like, what? And I just feel the need to share it because it's very strange, is that Reinhold H., which I forgot to look up his actual last name. Maybe they're not releasing it. I don't know. Anyway, he's 94 years old, and a trial is just starting now for or against him because he was a Nazi guard. He's accused of being an accessory to murder of 170,000 people in Auschwitz, Poland, where he was a guard from, well, that's what he's being accused of, being a guard there from January 1943 until June 1944. And, yeah, it was just a strange story, and it was just strange to me to read of a 94-year-old being on trial for something, which he clearly needs to be on trial for. I'm not saying that, like, I'm not belittling the Holocaust.
It's just
a strange story to see a 94-year-old suddenly on trial.
So here's an interesting thing for me about the Holocaust. When I was in... Well, that's a terrible way to start. Worst story ever. But here's something that I always... Like, when we're talking about sort of, you know, mass crimes like this, he's on trial for being... For the deaths of 170,000 people. Who he... Mm-hmm. Like, he didn't, you know, shoot every single one of them. It's part of
right.
being, you know, part of a murder system.
Exactly.
When I was in eighth grade, we did a mock trial of President Truman for dropping the atom bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Oh my gosh, super interesting.
And it was fascinating, and, like, everybody in the class had different roles. Well, people, I think, volunteered to have different roles, and so you had to play characters. I was Oppenheimer, and you had to, like, know all the backstory, and so you got some pamphlets, but then you also had to do some reading about, like, what was your character doing during, you know, World War II, and what was the Manhattan Project, and blah, 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 blah. And, in the end, we had, like, people come up as witnesses from the bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and basically they just told these horrific testimonies about what happened. And so the jury, i.e. the rest of the class, decided to indict President Truman for his war crimes, right, for having destroyed Nagasaki and Hiroshima and the long-term effects of that, and, you know, like, all of the awful cancers and everything that happened to people, not just at the time, but then for decades after. Mm-hmm. And so we finish this up and, you know, the judge hands down a sentence, and then we turn to our teacher and we say, so what really happened in the trial? And she's like, there was no trial of President Truman. Yeah. Everybody celebrates him as a hero for ending World War II by bombing Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I always think of that when I think of things like this, where, like, there's, when is death considered something you need to be put on trial for? Like, you need to be tried for this murder of 170,000 people because you were an accessory to the Nazi regime, which is obviously terrible. But then we don't try anyone for their involvement in World War II, which killed far more people. Because, right. like, those are, we consider those Japanese deaths legitimate, even though they were women, children, and civilians.
Right.
But because we needed to win the war, those deaths are legitimate and not up for being tried as war crimes. And I just...
Yeah.
I
agree with that struggle completely, 100%. I think there's also a difference between doing an act like that as a war, as part of a war, and rounding people up and putting them in concentration camps.
And that's true. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where it hits. And I am back and forth on Hiroshima and Nagasaki all the time. Because in the one instance, it did end a war. In the other instance, it murdered a ton of people right. and screwed up everything in that region. And yeah. But yeah, I think for me personally, it lies between this was an act of war and this was an act of intense oppression and discrimination.
Yeah. That's a great clarifying point. Thanks, Carrie.
You're welcome. Let's move on to more fun stuff.
Let's do it.
Because we can do that now, right?
Yeah, let's move on.
Okay. Hey, it's Valentine's Day on Sunday.
Yay!
Which is cool for people in relationships. Probably not so cool for people not in relationships. So just keep that in mind when you're doing stuff.
Yeah, especially if you're, you know, leading prayers or anything on Sunday. Like, it's good to recognize that it's Valentine's Day, but know that when you're recognizing that, you're kind of like, you're reminding all the people who are facing Valentine's Day for the first time and are divorced or have lost someone recently or are widowed that their person isn't with them anymore. So do that with care and tenderness.
Yeah.
And don't reinforce heteronormativity. Okay, thanks, bye.
Okay, thanks, bye.
Good job, America. I'm really sorry, pastors, preachers, and teachers, you're going to have to know about this on Sunday. I'm really sorry. Kanye West played his Yeezy Season 3 event in Madison Square Garden on Thursday, and he premiered his song Famous. The song Famous includes a line, "I feel like me and Taylor might still have sex. Why I made that word for a woman that is not appropriate, famous."
A female dog who has
female dog
puppies.
Yeah. Oddly enough, saying that you think you're gonna have sex with, presumably, Taylor Swift in a song and calling her the name of a female dog creates a media backlash.
Yeah.
Kanye has published, I think, a series of tweets or maybe some other sort of social media that says, like, "I talked about it with my wife and she was fine with it. Taylor and I are on good terms. She's the one who suggested the line." Taylor has not yet responded. So, this is something that your youth are probably going to mention, maybe, if you have youth who are into Kanye West or Taylor. Maybe they're totally over, and I just don't know because I'm 30 and I'm old, but, it is the continuing saga of Kanye West and Taylor Swift, just being weird.
Yeah. Kanye also this week, I believe it was this week, tweeted in all caps, "Bill Cosby innocent."
Oh, geez, Kanye.
So that was fun. But it was interesting to watch the firestorm back. And the most interesting one, which I can't remember now to quote, but was from Sarah Silverman, who is a comedian. And she just replied, and she was like, no. Like, she was like, over 50 women have come forward, and you need to respect that, or something. Like, completely serious. And I was like, all right.
She's fantastic.
As I mentioned before, Deadpool comes out this week. I'm going to go see it, so don't let my rant fool you. Yeah. Also, Zoolander 2 is coming out, which Zoolander is the movie that I'm like part of me is like, I should not find this movie funny, because like, part of me is like, Carrie, you're better than that. And then the like 98% else of me is like, this is hilarious. And I love this movie. So, I mean, Zoolander had David Bowie judging a walk-off contest.
That's like, true.
There's just magical moments in that film. So Zoolander 2 comes out this week. Also, the movie How to Be Single comes out. It's Rebel Wilson. Other people.
Yeah, some girl.
That I can't remember their name.
Some attractive,
one girl,
up-and-coming actress.
She was in 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh, yeah. I wondered where I knew her from.
Yep, that. And then, as well as some older standbys. They're in the movies, and I'm excited.
I need to asterisk that. I had to watch 50 Shades of Grey previews for some show that I was watching. I have never seen that movie, nor read that book.
Oh, yeah. I should also say.
Yeah.
I only know that from previews and from previous interviews with her on Jimmy Fallon promoting the movie. I have also not seen the movie, nor read the book.
I kind of want to imagine that, okay, I don't know a lot about 50 Shades of Grey. I know that it is considered an entry into BDSM culture. I know that a lot of people in BDSM culture hate it because it brought in all these people who think what they know what BDSM culture is and they actually don't. It's this basically borderline abusive non-consensual relationship between two adults where the man is like, I'm your dominant person, so I'm gonna like take control of you and do whatever I want even when you don't want me to. and she puts up with it because she's in love with him, I guess. Again, haven't seen it. But
yeah.
I really like the idea that they don't end up together. So if I was going to go see How to Be Single, I'm going to imagine that this is like the fifth movie in the 50 Shades of Grey series. That, like, all right, we tried that and I didn't enjoy it and now I'm going to be happy.
Right.
But it seems like How to Be Single from the previews is mostly about like how to have fun with boys and get laid without dating them. Which is not really being single, it's just not being in a committed relationship.
Right.
Do you feel like it's different?
I mean, yeah. Again, I haven't seen it, so it's based only on previews. Part of me is like, yay, because it seems like what was typically before a boy movie or like
right.
a guy of That's like, I'm going to sleep with as many women as I can, which is very popular and very present in our culture. And so part of me is like, what's up, flipping the tables, yo? Kind of like Amy Schumer has done recently.
Totally.
And then part of me is like, yeah, but like, let's not promote unhealthy relationships.
Yeah.
You know, like, and not saying that you have to be in a committed, like, long-term relationship in order to have a healthy relationship, but, you know, just watch yourself.
Yeah, just like, it seemed like there was, like, taking strangers home from bars and stuff, and I was like, you know what, that's the good way to get your car stolen. At best. Best outcome.
That was awesome. Okay.
Pride and Prejudice and Zombies is out in theaters. Probably not going to be out in theaters for very long, because I'm going to be really honest with you guys. It's terrible. if you loved Pride and Prejudice, the 1995 BBC version, you will find lots of homages to it in Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. If you liked the book Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, the movie is a pretty significant detraction from the book. I love the book, I love the movie, but it is pretty, like, script-writing awful, goofy, silly. And there's a significant amount of blood splatter, so if you don't like that, don't see it.
I figured I'd just let you take Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, because I haven't seen it yet, and there was quite the tweet storm happening there for a
bit. So happy. Yeah, I went with two people who don't appreciate the book Pride and Prejudice, the book Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, or either Pride and Prejudice movie. And I was like, why are you two even here? Just leave.
I appreciated Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, but I liked Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter more.
Yes, I've heard that from a lot of people.
That's the same author. But I also highly appreciate the BBC Pride and Prejudice, like, 15-hour
right.
version. Mainly for Mary playing the piano, because it makes me laugh every single time.
When she sings, and she's so terrible. Sadly, there's no piano or singing in Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
Sad.
Well, because they're, you know, they're trained in the delicate art of beheading zombies, so there's no, like, book reading.
There's no, like, book reading or piano playing.
Yeah.
I just remember so clearly in my 10th grade English literature class, we watched that entire thing.
For real?
For real, in high school, we watched the entire thing, and I just remember sitting there, and Mary playing, and my friend Sandra being like, ah! And then, like, trying to cover it up, and then every time she came on screen, the whole class would, like, giggle, and it was awesome.
I do think it is a really faithful adaptation. I know that a lot of people who saw, I mean, I think whichever Pride and Prejudice movie you see first, whether it's the BBC or the Keira Knightley version, you sort of imprint on that, and you expect the other one to be like that, and then you're mad that, like, it doesn't have certain lines that the other people wrote in. So, I don't know, you can turn the whole thing into, like, a really interesting commentary on original story and then what directors do with it, but
yeah,
mostly Pride and Prejudice. One of my most favorite terrible movies is Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters, and I would say Pride and Prejudice and Zombies is slightly better, which makes it not as hilarious. So.
Awesome. Speaking of The West Wing, a long time
as
ago,
as we often
in this
do,
podcast, but as I often do on this podcast and in life, the writer of the West Wing, Aaron Sorkin, which don't let that color your opinion of, or do you know what? Yeah, Aaron Sorkin is adapting the novel To Kill a Mockingbird, to be shown on Broadway, not a musical. Just a lot of people are like, hey, Broadway musical. No, it's a play. Although a musical of To Kill a Mockingbird would be very interesting.
I was thinking it was a musical, so that My hopes are a little dashed now.
I've heard it was a play, but, you know, maybe, I don't know, I could be wrong, I guess.
I was about to say, like, well, I guess you can't really do a musical about it because it's depressing. And then I was like, whatever, Spring Awakening is depressing as heck.
Well, hello, Les Mis.
Yeah, that's very true.
Anyway.
We challenge you, Aaron Sorkin. Get Lin-Manuel Miranda on that and do some amazing collaboration.
I want to see Boo Radley just freestyle rap now. That's, like, all I want in my
life.
That'd
be amazing, especially if he doesn't speak throughout the entire rest of the show.
Yeah.
And then
because you don't see him until the end of the novel. And right. So if he just, like, comes out after... Am I spoiling things? It's, like, a 40-year-old novel. Just read it.
If you haven't read this book, go back to ninth grade English.
Exactly. But, like, for him to have saved, like, Scout's life and then be on the porch and do, like, a Hamilton-style rap.
Yeah. Like a Guns and Ships.
I just didn't know that was missing from my life.
Also what needs to happen is that, like, everything needs to freeze. Like, there's a whole bunch of other characters around them, and only he and Scout are interacting during it, and everybody else pretend it never happened. Because she understands Boo Radley on a level that nobody else does.
No one else does. And I believe he understands her on a level no one else does.
Yeah, exactly.
That's just so wonderful.
You're welcome, Internet. Go make it happen.
Go make it happen.
Write in campaign.
We commission you to do this. I'm going to contact Aaron Sorkin and be like, hey.
Do it. Tweet at him. Tweet at both of them.
Oh my gosh, I'm doing that this afternoon.
Great.
Neither one will probably reply, but it's going to happen.
Do it anyway, just in case.
Yes. Also, speaking of Broadway, Disney's doing a Frozen musical, because obviously... I think they're either starting or it's gonna come out in 2018. There's something about 2018.
Okay. Yeah, they're probably gonna, like, cast it and rehearse it.
Cast it, and then, I mean, as a casual watcher of Frozen, they're gonna need, like, I am saying this, so maybe there's other things out there, but, like, that second act is gonna need some more songs.
Yeah, that's very true.
So, and they gotta, like, stage it all, and there's that whole previews thing, and I watched the show Smash, so.
So you basically know how this works.
So I'm basically an expert on how Broadway musicals
can be. Is that show still on?
No, it was canceled after, like, 2 seasons.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. Our friend Evan watches it on a very regular basis.
I think that's why I thought it was still on.
Yeah. Because he still talks about it quite a bit.
Carrie, we don't have in our notes the most important cultural event of this week. Which is that Harry Potter and the Curse of Child is going to be released as a book.
We don't!
So, gentle listeners.
I kind of assumed it was happening, but anyway, continue.
Gentle listeners, J.K. Rowling, who said that she wasn't going to write any more about Harry Potter, and then proceeded to write more about Harry Potter, for which no one is angry.
Right.
Released a play in London. You may remember a couple weeks ago we talked about how they cast this play for Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, and they controversially, to some, cast Hermione as black. Which is fantastic, because the book never actually says whether or not Hermione is black. And the actress who plays her looks stunning, so that's great.
Right, which J.K. Rowling quoted. Like, she was like, all it says is frizzy hair and something about her teeth.
Yep.
And brown eyes, so obviously she can be black. And Emma Watson was like, oh, this is awesome! So,
good job, Emma. So the show's playing in London, and of course many, many Harry Potter fans around the world have been like, oh, but we can't get to London. Why are you doing this to us? And so they're putting the script out as a book, a printed script. Are we excited? Are we nervous? I don't know what we are. I'm nervous because I just want everybody to be okay. And the fact that it's called Harry Potter and the Cursed Child and that there have been suggestions that something's wrong with little Albus makes me so sad. So, I like my fiction to be escapist, where everybody ends up okay in the end, because that's not the way the world usually works, and I'm a little concerned.
For being quite similar, we take our fiction very differently. I like being an escapist, but I also like bad things happening. Like, I don't like bad things happening, but, like, it intrigues me. Like, the Batman movies, like, I'm just like, oh my gosh. I like ambiguity and, like, darkness in my literature.
No, I like my characters black and white.
Yep, you do. I like so much gray area, it's ridiculous. I am personally, like, I'm really excited for it. Also, points of clarity, it's not, like, a novel. It's the printed,
right,
like, script. A lot of people are like, it's the 8th Harry Potter book. And I'm like, well, yeah, but also know that it's, you know. And I am excited for it. I'm also very nervous because there's... okay, I grew up with Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. Like, when he was 11, I was 11. And we pretty much, you know, they pretty much came out in the orders of, like, I was that age when I read that book. And so, like, Harry Potter, is very much a part of my childhood.
Yes.
And my growing up from ages 11 to 17. Cause you do quite a bit of growing up there. I wasn't completely grown up at 17, but like, you know, you do a lot of growth.
Right.
So, I am nervous because I don't want that being ruined for me. And I don't want, you know, like when I get to the end of the 7th book, and I turn the page and the epilogue is there and I'm like, ooh.
Right.
Like, do I read this or don't I read this time? And so I don't want that part of my childhood being reopened and then like damaged somehow.
Yeah.
That is my issue.
I wrote a really interesting analysis that basically it was a very British ending to have the epilogue and essentially the kids repeating their parents' battles again, you know, like, and everybody's going off to Hogwarts, and there's still this sort of tense relationship with Slytherin, and we tease Hermione's daughter about being really smart, and they're essentially sort of repeating what their parents did, and that this is very British, that the sort of, like, the idea that you will be at your same sort of parent station, and you'll follow in their footsteps, is very core to the British ideology. And for Americans, we were like, what the heck is this? Because we've grown up in this culture that's like, every generation can be better than their parents.
Right.
And then especially for millennials, where, like, the economy imploded on us. You know, we came of age in, like, the 90s when everything was going to be amazing and awesome. And the economy was booming and everything was going to be great. And, like, every child would grow up to be president and have cookies all the time. And then everything just completely fell out from the bottom of us. To have the battle just continually re-waged, where, like, the best thing you can hope for is that you get to go off to private school and have the same sort of inter-house rivalries that your parents had, that was very upsetting to us.
Yeah. I can see that.
So we're... But we're both going to read the book, obviously.
Well, obviously we're going to read the book. Are we going to...
Yes. Yes, we are.
Oh my gosh. Sorry, I just realized that. I got really excited. Okay. Anyway, when I first read the epilogue, I did like it. I wasn't like, hey! Like, I was like, this is okay.
Yeah.
But the thing that I was missing is that I wanted to know more about what they were doing. Like, was like, is Harry an Auror? Like, did that happen? And, like,
right.
You know, like, I wanted more out of it than what I got was my main issue with it.
Right. Absolutely.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, we need to do our podcast of the of Harry Potter and the London Flat.
Yes, we do.
We really should be doing that.
It's just hard to come up with your own material rather than to recap others and go on.
I think we just have to read a lot of Tumblr posts and combine them into a 30-minute podcast every week. Anyway, well, preachers, teachers, and other leaders of the church, I don't know where to leave you. It's been, I mean, the news is always up and down, right? Because the things that come to our attention in worldwide news are always going to be things that are hard and sad, and they're not always black and white, as much as I would like things to be. And we are asking you, as leaders of the church, and as shapers of Christ's disciples, to help people deal with the fact that not everything is always black and white, that there is not only gray, but a rainbow of ways to interpret and to decide how to act. And so we are hoping with this podcast to equip you to understand how to react to different things that are happening in the news, to be prepared for conversations that may pop up on Sunday mornings, and to be more informed about the world that we live in and the world that God made and the world that Christ calls us to be active in. So with that, a blessed and holy Lent to all of you, and we will talk to you again next week.